I hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting and talking down to me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let the song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. That's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And, of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in a European heartland. Well, lots more news and views for our people, and hardly know where to start, but California on the verge of becoming our first third world state of disease, trash, homelessness, plague of major cities. Now, picture here of a Chicano woman digging through garbage. Thanks to left-wing Democratic policies that reward bad behavior, a number of California's biggest cities are becoming cesspools of trash and disease as the state teeters on becoming our first third-world enclave. Earlier this month, the Los Angeles Times reported that rats had infested City Hall thanks to all the local dumping and buildup of trash in homeless camps. When faced with complaints earlier this year from city workers about rats infesting LA City Hall, most city officials said little about whether the problem was connected to several homeless camps right outside, which of course is that might be politically incorrect. But a newly uncovered report from a pest control company hired by the city has raised fresh questions about whether officials wrongly downplayed that possibility during discussions at city council meetings. CATS, as in the feline, CATS USA Pest Control, brought in to assess areas outside City Hall and nearby buildings, warned that homeless people create a harborage for rodents. According to the report issued December 28th of last year and obtained last month to a public records request by a frequent critic of City Hall. Apparently, the report had been buried. The company said it found poor sanitary conditions, including leftover food, human waste, and hypodermic needles, and recommended that the city clear away the homeless population living in the civic center. Town Hall's Matt Vespa, as quote, Dr. Drew Pinsky, said this month that there has been a total and complete breakdown of services in the city, and that's placed the population at risk of infection and other health-related issues. The mayor's office has sought to shift blame away from the homeless, citing the illegal dumping of trash, which only adds to the narrative that Deep Blue California and LA are just Democratic cesspools. Quote, we have a complete breakdown of the basic needs of civilization in Los Angeles right now, Pinsky told Fox News. Third world countries are insulted if they are accused of being like this. No city on earth tolerates this. The entire population is at risk. What's more, LA Mayor Eric Garcetti is in denial, meaning the problem is only bound to get worse. According to CBS Los Angeles, he's not blaming the city's homeless, but rather the illegal dumping of trash. Quote, most of the things we saw in the news recently are from illegal dumping, not from homeless folks. So it's also important not to blame folks that are living on the streets for everything that we see, Garcetti said. Well, would that account for human waste? In other words, Los Angelinos are supposed to pretend that one problem, homelessness, doesn't cause or lead to others, like dumping of trash, presence of used hypodermic needles, rising disease, and rat infestations. And this can't be said enough. Let's never forget, these enclaves are all due to Democratic policies. Which begs the question, why do Californians who live in these cities continue voting for the same policies, the same Democrats, over and over again, while expecting a different result? That is the textbook definition of insanity. That's exactly what it is. Insanity. Well, I want to thank Dave Perry for sending that my way. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. I want to thank Joe Felici for sending me this great article by a good internet friend of mine, a great writer and critic and all-around patriot, Michael Walsh. And we have trouble getting that up for the moment, so we're going to another issue. This is Diane Francis. She's a writer in the National Post, and actually the Financial Post, which is an offshoot of the National Post. And she writes, immigration now like an open invite dinner party. The United States and Canada have built their economies by accepting millions of immigrants for centuries. Interestingly, polls in the U.S. now support, and that show support is holding, while 63% of Canadians want to limit immigration levels. Interesting. The difference is perplexing, especially since Canada doesn't have more than 12 million undocumented migrants sneaking in or applying for asylum, as does the U.S. But the facts are that, proportionate to our population, we have very high levels and a government that said that in 2017 set an arbitrary goal of bringing a million more over 3 years by 2020, or around 330,000 annually, instead of around 230,000 a year, which is what the Conservatives were doing, but that was still too much, or too many. For starters, the setting of a static immigration goal for 1 or 2 or 3 years is foolish in and of itself. Migration should vary and be based, for the most part, on the need for unskilled or specialty labor, as well as economic conditions. Frankly, this 1 million, half of whom are family immigrants and not economically freestanding immigrants, is unsustainable. Equivalent to the population of both Ottawa and Edmonton. That's a lot of health care, education costs, infrastructure pressure, and housing shortages. But the Liberals are undaunted. Trudeau's immigration minister, that's the Somali immigration lawyer, Ahmed Hassan, rebutted to polling results that immigration is not
a zero-sum situation, and that more money, read the tax dollars, will be invested in these areas for these newcomers. This is the argument of a trust fund kid. You know, if they're already costing us money, but we can get it right if we invest more money, no. That's wrong. The Liberals claim that the huge increase in immigration is required to fill skill shortages, but nearly half of those admitted won't be working, perhaps ever, and wouldn't qualify to be admitted as economic immigrants with skills. Besides, this old chestnut of an excuse is being trotted out repeatedly forever, and yet shortages persist. Or do they? For one thing, most of the immigrants selected are not selected according to job needs, and the actual labor shortage is much overblown. We've got 6-point-something% official unemployment, which would work out to at least 10%. Why are not employers training the unemployed, if indeed there are shortages? Usually when business cries piteously about labor shortage, what they mean is cheap labor shortage. Well, anyway, back to Diane Francis. The Liberals also add that more immigration is needed to boost the size of the country's population overall. But the vast majority of new entrants will end up crowding into a handful of already crowded cities like Toronto, Vancouver, Calgary, Edmonton, Montreal, essentially. Canada's immigration department should return to behaving like the human resources department of the country. People should be given entry if they fill a job that a Canadian cannot perform. Instead, the Liberals are like a human resources department that recruits people, then hopes they can find jobs or match those already posted. A small percentage of humanitarian immigration is also required of rich countries, but they should only recruit people living in refugee camps with bona fide needs, not those who merely show up and say so. That's a horde so far, about 43,000 illegals who stormed across the American border into the Roxham Road area of Quebec, because, well, that's right, there's only a field separating the two countries. You say only a field, you mean with a fence or a wall? No, nothing. Well, when they started pouring across, or dribbling across, actually in December 2016, and the dribble became a flood in the spring of 2017, wouldn't a prudent government build a fence, or at least put some personnel down there? Nope. Well, not a fence, one on a wall. Well, I'll tell you, because they don't really want to stop them. The replacement of the white people of Canada, the European founding settler people, is the end game goal of the immigration policies of the two major parties, Conservative and Liberal. Maybe less so for the Conservatives, or less explicitly so, but for the Liberals, they can't get rid of traditional Canadians fast enough. And Diane Francis continues, a small percentage, she's already done that. The number of refugees or asylum seekers, immigration is what began the public reaction. In 2017, the naive prime minister, if indeed he was naive, tweeted to kind of put a finger up the nose of Donald Trump. An open-ended welcome and sparked a flood of 43,000 alleged asylum seekers at the U.S.-Quebec border. Most will be deported eventually. Well, I think she's being rather hopeful. Over 50% will have their claim denied, so that's not most. Well, it is, I guess. But of those will, just because they're denied, doesn't necessarily mean that their dusky butts will be turfed out of the country. Most will be, she says, will be deported eventually because they're not refugees or already committed, admitted into the U.S. as asylum seekers. Most are queue jumpers or jurisdiction shoppers, You've cost the taxpayers more than $300 million and counting. I mean, look, this is not a humanitarian gesture without cost. It's exceedingly costly. And, you know, you have to ask, well, who's paying for it? Well, you are, if you're a Canadian taxpayer. You're paying for it. Diane Francis continues in her article. They were escorted by smugglers through a forest path in Quebec to avoid official border checkpoints. To Quebec, actually, through a forest in the United States, and to avoid border checkpoints where they'd have been turned back to the U.S. Asylum system, pointed out Tory leader Andrew Scheer. Quote, there's absolutely nothing fair or compassionate about forcing the oppressed to wait longer for Canada's help while others jump the queue, exploit loopholes, and cross the border illegally from places like upstate New York, that's the Conservative leader said. Fortunately, talks with the U.S. have cleaned up the situation, and the number of crossers into Canada has dropped, and deportations are happening. Well, I don't think they've dropped nearly enough. You know, a serious country mans the border with troops or officers who turn the illegals back. That's what a serious country does. Or if that's a bit, it gets beyond the friendly persuasion, you build a fence. Or if the fence is likely to be penetrated, you build a wall. But you show the invaders you're serious. In fact, the signals we've sent is we're not really serious. And she concludes, Canada or the U.S. and Europe are not open invitation dinner parties that anyone is entitled to attend and the taxpayers must pay for. See, that's the searing unfairness of it. The alleged rights, in quotation marks, of illegals ends up trumping the rights of taxpayers, which doesn't seem fair. It's our country. Well, very occasionally, even somebody like Bernie Farber, now Bernie M. Farber was for a long time the Chief Executive Officer of the Canadian Jewish Congress. Now, the Canadian Jewish Congress went out of existence a few years ago and morphed or became a new organization, the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs. And Farber, for some reason, did not continue on. He became the CEO of something called Mosaic, which is a multi-culti organization, among other things. It was plumping for more rights and recognition of Roma, in case you aren't quite up on political correctees. Roma are what we generally call gypsies. Well, now he's moved on again. Now he's the CEO of a group called the Canadian Anti-Hate Network. Now, don't confuse that with really being against hate. It's Canadian Anti-Free Speech Network. Farber has been a stalwart enemy of free speech going back to his days in the Canadian Jewish Congress. Anyway, on that he's been consistent. Anyway, you'll recall that just recently AOC, Alexandria Octavio-Cortez, proclaimed that the detention camps in the United States for illegals were concentration camps. Now, many people have tweeted her on that, and Bernie Farber is actually uncharacteristically going to agree with her. I'll tell you why, because he, among others, has been one of these people who've jealously guarded the term Nazi. And when people start talking about smoking Nazis or feminazis, what they meant were these anti-smoking fanatics that would want to ban smoking for not just in a room but a building and or even so many yards from the doors of the building and so on. These totalitarians were sometimes called smoking Nazis,
and militant man-hating men, man-hating women were called feminazis. Well, Jewish groups, people like Farber too, began to disagree. They wanted a monopoly on Nazis. Nazis have to be people we say are Nazis. For instance, the Canadian Anti-Hate Network, presumably either it's released either written by Farber or at least approved by him, after I assisted Kevin Goudreau, who's a white nationalist, and he was being victimized by another member of the Canadian Anti-Hate Network, Richard Warman, when I appeared in an Ottawa court for a very brief appearance when Warman was trying to get a peace bond, and that was, of course, was the issue of our last show. In the write-up of the event by the Canadian Anti-Hate Network, it was noted that neo-Nazi Kevin Goudreau was in a court, and assisting him was neo-Nazi Paul Fromm. So the people like Farber and the Jewish lobby like to kind of control who gets called a Nazi. I'll tell you why. Well, they would say, well, if you call militant feminists feminazis, it cheapens the term Nazi, or it spreads it too thin. Nazis are, well, followers of National Socialism, literally, or whoever we say they are. Now, I am not I've not proclaimed myself to be a National Socialist, and I would never call myself a neo-Nazi. I'll tell you why. And I mentioned this before, but it's well worth getting out there in general consciousness. Nazi was not what the National Socialists ever called themselves. Nazi was a term of abuse invented by their enemies, the communists, with the growth of the National Socialist Party and movement in the 1920s. And Nazi was a short form for Ignaz. Ignaz was your stereotypical Bavarian country boy, kind of big and goofy and not very bright. And so what the communists were saying was that the supporters of National Socialism were country bumpkins or Ignatzes, or to put it into North American context, Bubbas. Well, the National Socialists never called themselves Nazis, because that'd be like saying I'm a Bubba. And similarly, if you are a follower of National Socialism, and I know many people who are, as Hitler's work, particularly his economic work, his miracle, it was a miracle that he pulled off in Germany, gets some sane, considered thought. And that is, of course, one of the reasons for the endless caterwauling about the Holocaust. If we can just, or if the enemies of National Socialism and can just keep it forever in people's mind, Hitler, 6 million Jews, perhaps people will not look at Hitler's accomplishments, which may be relevant today. Anyway, Farber is going a little bit beyond that. Now he's saying, well, we've got to be careful about the use of concentration camp. That is, has to be specifically used for National Socialists or others when we say it. This article, much of which I would not agree with, but cry to humankind, normal people call it, cry to mankind, but okay. The term concentration camp is not a Nazi invention, but whatever the words we want to use to describe conditions at U.S. immigration detention centers, children are dying. So he's a little bit on both sides. On June 18th, U.S. Member of Congress Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez stunned the world when she called the Trump administration's border detention centers for illegals, my word, not his, concentration camps. Quote, this administration has established concentration camps on the southern border of the United States for immigrants. But they're not immigrants, they're invaders. They're illegals.
where they are being brutalized with dehumanizing conditions and dying, she tweeted. This is not hyperbole. It is the conclusion of expert analysis, as she said. Well, yeah, yes, there are a few who have died. But in any human population, there will be people who die of age, of illness, whatever. And there are so many, it's not surprising there have been a few deaths. But they haven't been beaten to death or starved to death. The Trump administration, Farber continues, has upped its efforts against, he says, migrants. They are illegals, of course, crossing the U.S. border. Despite the public outcry last year over children being separated from their families. There are some 200 immigration detention facilities in the U.S., and many of them operated by private companies. He goes on to say, Selke Shaw, that's a person, I guess, executive director of the U.S.-based Detention Network, the Detention Watch Network, a national coalition founded in 1997 to combat the explosive growth of immigration detention facilities in the U.S., calls the centers, quote, dangerous places where lives are at risk and people are dying. At least 24 people have died in the detention centers since the Trump administration renewed its crackdown on immigration, six of them children. Widespread physical abuse of the detainees, so he claims, is also being reported. Well, you know, there are a couple of observations there. I am sure conditions in detention camps are not wonderful. I mean, you've got, they're crowded. These illegals keep pouring in. It's probably not like a stay at the Holiday Inn. But whose fault is that? They chose to barge into another country. Now, I would agree they don't deserve to be abused, but their lobby, of course, likes to lay it on very, very thick. Okay, as we get into the heart of Mr. Farber's argument. Erica Guevara Rosas, Amnesty International's America's director, has described conditions at the centers where rudimentary cages are overflowing with illegals as spectacularly cruel and nothing short of torture. Torture being put in the cage is actually is like a cell. It's just for a large number of people. It's so they don't get out. Well, if you go to prison, you're in a cage. And very interestingly, the Obama administration, weak as they were, also built these cage-like detention areas. But of course, because they hate Trump so much, out comes the concentration camp board. An investigation of the U.S. Inspector General of four facilities found unsanitary conditions in bathrooms, detainees fed expired food, and given a general lack of medical care and personal hygiene items. The report also noted inappropriate segregation practices, including detainees kept in restraints when let outside their cells, well, for fear they escape. The reaction of many to Ocasio-Cortez's comments, including Republicans, fellow Democrats, Jewish leaders, and even some historians, was swift. How dare she compare the detention of asylum seekers, or illegals, they said, to Jews in Auschwitz and other camps during the Holocaust. In fact, Ocasio-Cortez drew a distinction between concentration camps and death camps. So, Farber will agree that they are concentration camps. No, they're not. They're detention camps. But because they're not specifically designed to kill, they're not death camps. Well, that will seem to be his argument. I'm a child of the Holocaust. I'm a child of a Holocaust survivor, he says. Survivors, right? Lots of them. The Jews of my father's entire village in eastern Poland were gassed to death and in a concentration camp. But not in a concentration camp, but in a death camp called Treblinka.
I've heard this tale many times from Farber. I really wonder, okay, well, how did his father escape if everybody in the village got gassed in Treblinka? Assuming that it happened. Anyway, it goes on to say the Nazis ran a number of concentration camps as well as death camps. So there were brutal, horrible places where many thousands died from forced labor, disease, and malnutrition. Many were simply shot. You've got to think very, very carefully about this. What is actually being described are labor camps. Now, with most able-bodied young men off at war, as the war continued, there was indeed a labor shortage in National Socialist Germany. They needed a people, they need workers. And so they impressed some people from Poland, and they impressed the Jews who'd been detained to do that work. And so places like Auschwitz-Birkenau, despite Mr. Farber say so, were in fact work camps or labor camps, and where people were sent out, Jews and non-Jews, to add to the labor force. Now, this of course is not a very happy interpretation. Because the Holocaust tale revolves around these being death camps. Well, if they were death camps, well, why did so many people survive? I mean, if the purpose is to kill people, why would you put them in a camp to kill them? And just shoot them. It's wartime. Transportation costs money. Fuel is extremely scarce in National Socialist Germany. Anyway. So he anguishes about whether they should be called concentration camps or death camps. He agrees the conditions are terrible for these illegals. Well, they're not, actually. And he says that while their conditions were more, these are the illegals, are more humane than the Spanish and Nazi versions, they were by historical definitions concentration camps. So why the battle over words? It's a shameful attempt by Republicans to take the focus off the horrible conditions under which children are dying from lack of, they're not dying from lack of care. Some arrive sick, and their utterly irresponsible parents or whoever is accompanying them are largely to blame for this. But what of those of my own Jewish community who have voiced rapier-like criticism? Even Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem, has taken Ocasio-Cortez to task for what they see as a misappropriation of the term. See, only we can, we will decide what are concentration camps. The endless chutzpah of the Jewish lobby. He goes on to say, Jewish historian Anna Lynn Guzik calls the decision tragic, noting that Yad Vashem's embrace of visitors like Viktor Orban, the anti-Semitic ethno-nationalist Hungarian prime minister. So he visited Yad Vashem for God knows what reason, but because clearly the Jewish lobby doesn't like him, Farber's calling him an anti-Semite. She argues in a recent article for Voxcom that it isn't just accurate for detention centers to be called concentration camps. It's necessary. Well, actually, I'll digress from Farber's article. The first concentration camps were disgracefully built by the British. And they were to contain the Afrikaners, or Boers, mostly women and children, some old men, and it was to be some form of blackmail against the fighting men. So the women and children and old men were put into a number of really cruel detention camps, and they were called concentration camps. And cruelty and deprivation of food and medicine was part of the policy. It was not an accident of war. It wasn't that, as happened in the spring of 1945, as conditions across Germany were appalling because of the bombing. Germany was losing the war, was in its final throes, and everything was breaking down. And yes, there was deprivation in the detention camps, and some people, like Anne Frank, died of it. She didn't die of deprivation. She died of typhus, which is a disease, often diarrhea, etc., often spread when sanitary conditions break down. What the British built were detention camps. Were concentration camps. What the Germans built, despite what Farber says, were detention camps, a place to detain a highly unreliable and often subversive element of the German population, and that was the Jews, and others, some others. Anyway, Farber goes on to say, as he's quoting this other writer, this Annalyn Guzik, while the Holocaust is unique in its scale and implementation, the perpetrators and motivations are not, she writes. Yad Vashem was not alone in criticism of Ocasio-Cortez. The Anti-Defamation League and the Simon Wiesenthal Center have also joined in a chorus of condemnation. Even Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders, who's incidentally Jewish, refused to defend Ocasio-Cortez. You don't know whom to side with in this. The Holocaust is unique. Well, yes and no. It's a special event for the Jewish people because it happened to them, whatever it was. It's not a unique event in human history. I'll tell you why. Because even if you take the wildly exaggerated and actually untenable figure of 6 million. There were far worse atrocities in the 20th century. For instance, the 8 to 10 million Ukrainians deliberately starved to death by Soviet communist policy, implemented in many cases by Jews in 1932-33. Well, 8's bigger than 6, so it's not unique. Critics, Farber goes on to say, critics have interpreted Ocasio-Cortez's use of the term concentration camp as an attempt to inject Nazi imagery into the asylum seeker debate. But what I heard is a cry to humankind to ensure that what happened to European Jews in the Nazi kingdom of death never happens to anyone else again. And the total bollocks and nonsense. There's no plan by Donald Trump's administration to exterminate the Central American illegals. Detain them until their status can be determined, and then they will either be let go or sent back. Now, I would not agree with his comparison his reference to the National Socialist work camps or detention camps. They were not created for death.
Continues in like vein.
I was rather disappointed in the Saturday National Post to see
an otherwise usually very witty and very perceptive and politically incorrect writer, Rex Murphy, weigh in against Ocasio-Cortez. Citing the Holocaust to prop up polls is beyond despicable, he says. And, you know, he trots out all the Zionist propaganda. Having criticized her, he continues, "I don't use words lightly. I use the word that word because that is what the administration that creates its concentration is. Never again means something." Now, this is Ocasio-Cortez using the one of the slogans of the Zionists after the Second World War: "Never again." Well, informed people would say, actually, there wasn't the first time. And Rex Murphy goes on. "Now, of all the infamies that various monsters of history have inflicted on the innocent of mankind, surely the concentration camps of the Second World War, called into being by Hitler and Himmler with the singular design of the extermination of every Jew the Nazi regime could bring to them, in conditions of the most brutal and degrading savagery that industrial-scale murder overseen by sadistic torturers and brutalist guards could achieve, those camps, the death factories of a Holocaust, may claim to be the mountain summit of human-made horror and woe." I've just got to, I wrote down their bullshit. "The purpose of the camps was not the destruction of every Jew the National Socialists could lay their hands on. If that had been the purpose, they would simply be shot on the spot. Why would one go through the elaborate and expensive exercise of putting these people in camps, where, among other things, there were swimming pools and theaters?" But it's just a regurgitation of nonsense. And he goes on, this is Rex Murphy, goes on to say, "The Holocaust and all its attendant slaughters is not a brand to be picked up lightly to prop up a poll or grab a headline or to show oneself a leader of the absurdly denominated resistance conducted by Hillaryite dead-enders and talk show chatter machines to a democratically elected president." Okay, so he's accusing her of basically trying to grab a headline by comparing the immigrant detention camps to the Holocaust. And he continues, I'm actually quite surprised at Rex Murphy. He says, talking about the detention camps in National Socialist Germany, "Children hauled from their own mothers' weeping arms, infants plucked from their breasts and tossed into ovens, dogs ripping at the prisoners as they were cattle prodded into the gas chambers." No credible historian would even write that anymore, that children were tossed into the gas oven, into the gas chambers. It's nonsense. This is white guilt tale has become almost a form of madness. Well, this is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me here on White Resistance Radio. Going to take my musical break, and I'm going to play some Buck Owens. Buck, those of you who can remember the old country and western music and the comedy show Hee Haw will remember Buck, and his Buckaroos were a regular feature on Hee Haw. Buck has now since passed on. He typified the country and western played in Bakersfield, sometimes even called Buckersfield, California, and one of his proteges, and is still a big hit today, and that's Dwight Yoakam. So Buck Owens.
They're gonna put me in the movies. They're gonna make a big star out of me. We'll make a film about a man that's sad and lonely. And all I gotta do is lives act naturally. Well, I'll bet you I'm gonna be a big star. Might win an Oscar, you can't never tell. The movie's gonna make me a big star. Cause I can play the part so well.
Just me. Francisco. I spent a night there in the can. Lived through this treatment in my jail cell. I took $15 from that man. Left him my watch and my old house key. Don't want folks thinking that I'd steal.
mind, every dream comes true. And my heart skips a beat when we walk down the street. I feel a trembling in my knees. And just to know your mind until the end of time makes my heart skip a beat.
That's a little blast of Buck Owens. This is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The shows will be at 8 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting and you're on the fighting side of me.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, Wolfe the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. At Queenston Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. Our fair dominion now extends from Cape Race to Nootka Sound. May peace forever be our lot and plenteous store abound. And may those ties of love be ours which discord cannot sever, and flourish green o'er freedom's home the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf.